Victor?
Yep. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, you sound great.
Okay, awesome.
Cool. So you're in Moscow now. Oh, no, I'm sorry, you're back in St. Petersburg visiting your folks, but you work more in Moscow.
Right.
So, Victor, tell me a little bit about the scene, the integral scene. It seems like when I cast about among my friends about who knew somebody Russian, you all pointed to each other and, you know, passed the ball off, and it seems like you know each other and there's something going on, and I've heard that, and so I'd like to hear it from you.
Well, it all starts with Ken Wilber's books, obviously, and they first were translated and published by the Transpersonal Association, the Russian Transpersonal Association, in the beginning of the 2000s. And so that's how most of the people got acquainted with the, well, with the whole integral movement. Then very small groups began to self-organize, and by 2007, mm-hmm. there were a few online communities exploring different facets of integral, and there was one integral salon or integral club, Moscow Integral Club. It still functions on weekly basis from, I think, since 2007 or 2008. Mm-hmm. So it has quite a history. And then I was one of the first moderators of the of one of the first online communities dealing with integral from, I think, 2009. And well, there are not very many people who are versatile with the integral topics, but I think all in all maybe 15 or 20 people. So yes, we all know each other. As for a more wider audience, I think many people read Wilber's books for sure, and there is a book on spiral dynamics translated, and then Peter McNabb's book on integral communication is translated into Russian, and then Big Mind, Big Heart. So all those kind of not integral, but those names which are which we all know from integral somehow. So people know about all this stuff, and then we organized a few small conferences, more like an integral get together for 20 or 30 people, something like that. And that's pretty much that. Now I work in a theater in Moscow. I have an integral group there, and that's how integral gets more popular, or we can say that more people know about integral through that activity, because the theater itself is quite a famous place. It's quite an elite, I'd say, place, which is on the news quite often. So when people know that something integral goes on there, and when its director and its main playwright talks about integral stuff and Ken Wilber, people listen. Okay, so I think it gets bigger and bigger by day. And
wow.
Now my friends and I, we launched an online journal which deals with post-metaphysical and basically all the post-disciplinary topics. So we decided that it's not what, but how we want to make it. So basically we allow all of the topics to get explored mm-hmm. there in the journal, but the perspective is what matters for us. So it has to mm-hmm. be integral in the post-metaphysical and post-disciplinary sense. So I think it gets bigger.
That's right.
And,
I'm all for that.
But yeah. So that's what we all like. and we all feel. And also, if you know the Integral Europe movement, which got also bigger these days, we have the first European Integral Conference in May.
Yes.
This May. So.
And that's in Budapest, right?
In Budapest, yes, exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Ben Segante is doing it.
Yes. I probably won't go there, but some of my friends from Russia and Ukraine go there for sure. So we are part of all. We want to feel like we are part of this movement.
Absolutely. It's so wonderful to meet you and to hear of what you're doing. And I wanted to, you know, with all of the attention and spotlight on Russia with the Olympics,
right.
You know, in what I do in my daily Evolver Tuesday night talks and on my blog is I just look at, you know, what's up in the world and where's the spotlight and just sort of trust that evolution and emergence has a hand in this and that in this moment, Russia is coming online in a way. So I just want to hear from you as to how that feels on the inside and what you're seeing and, you know, from an integral perspective, what do you think's going on?
You know, I feel like I myself is a little bit of an outsider as well because I spent the last 7 years living in China. So my perspective maybe is also a little colored by, you know, being, just spending so much time outside, but
right.
On the other hand, maybe some things are even more clear for me now that I'm back here because I maintain this more objective kind of perspective, so maybe it helps, I don't know. But it's really hard and somehow painful to talk about Russia and Russian fate and all that, or destiny, or whatnot. I can talk about it from a more integral perspective, meaning that I can, or we can together go and explore some of the stages that are, or the stages of development that are in play here in Russia currently with all the kind of protest movement and all the forces in power and all that, or we can go with a more kind of general perspective with all the where the money go, how the economy works, and all that. So,
I wouldn't mind exploring all of that. And what's most interesting to me is, you know, the thought. What's going on in terms of, you know, you're living in pretty much with the cutting edge. You're in Moscow. You're in the theater. You're integral, for God's sakes. I mean, you're really at the point of the arrow, and you have a perspective, and you're also talking to other integralists in the same situation. And really, don't you think that all great stories, all great literature is somehow about these different levels clashing and clanging the way forward? And just the conflict that is always up in these first-tier memes. And it's true everywhere. It's true here as well. But, you know, Russia has its own particular flavor of it. And then I also, Victor, come from a certain kind of, I guess, faith almost, that, you know, emergence is messy, and emergence is full of conflict. In fact, it seems that conflict is one of the engines of emergence.
Right.
So it's not always pretty.
Absolutely. Maybe I can give a little perspective on what's happening in Russia, but we have to begin with Peter the Great, which is
cool.
The beginning of the 18th century. If you're fine.
No, that's a good place to start.
Because it was for the first time since the beginning of the Russian civilization, which started at around 8th or 9th century AD, when things started to turn to a more enlightened as in the European European sense of the word, the perspective. So Peter the Great, he decided, he was a vicious person, and he killed a lot of people, and he put his own, he killed his own son for treason and so forth. But at the same time, he was all like pro-European and tried to build a modern way for, tried to conceive a modern way for Russia to evolve. So he changed a lot in ways Russia functioned as not only a political or economical entity, but as a cultural entity as well. So he changed a lot of things culturally. One of the main things. Yeah.
What year is this again? What era?
It's the beginning of the 18th century, right?
Okay.
And it won't take longer than 5 minutes, but I have to.
I'm not in a hurry. I'm placing myself there, man. You're sounding good.
All right. So he tried to revolutionize Russian economy and politics and culture, but do it in a more European way because Russia. Well, Russians love to think of themselves. We love to think of ourselves as a third way, not Asian, but not European as well. But in a sense, it is a European way. It is a Western type of civilization with all the Western achievements and all that. But at the same time, with Christianity that turned into the Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Christianity, our Dark Ages lasted longer, and they lasted basically till Peter the Great decided to end those Dark Ages and kind of bring Russia back to the European civilization. And so that he did, and then a more of and by that time it's a pure traditional society, so we could say it's like amber society.
Right.
And then he started to introduce Western European scientists and doctors and basically all of the elite. So very soon all of the Russian elite became European, speaking French, and they were European by origin also. Many people from Germany, many people from Netherlands, and so on. Many specialists, experts in their certain fields. And
yes.
Then by the 19th century, and it was largely influenced by Hegel and Marx, there appeared many groups within Russian more educated society who wanted to understand what can be Russian way of evolving from the Tsar's empire into something more democratic or whatnot. Yeah, because no one knew basically, but those people in the first part, second part, basically in the 19th century, they were trying to. They could become, as I see it now, the founding fathers, of new Russian identity, of new Russian way of evolution. But they were too, what would be the word? Well, mostly they were writers and poets and people like that. Not that much people of action. Okay?
Right.
So it all influenced Russian culture a lot and Russian literature a lot. But it didn't change the society much, I would say. At the same time, probably the abolition of Russian slavery. I don't know the specific term. It's not slavery, technically speaking, but it is slavery anyway for the peasantry. And then the abolition of that, and then the assassination of one of the Tsars and so on. So things were changing pretty fast. And then when the Bolsheviks came and the the October Revolution came in 1917, things were developing toward a more orange society, right? Obviously, still the majority of the population is amber, but the ruling elite was changing into orange quite fast.
Right.
And by orange, I mean not in a business kind of way, not the business perspective, not the achiever perspective per se, but maybe a more world-centric, more democratic, and something like that.
Rights of man.
And, more liberal and more accepting and so on, more open. And then with the Bolshevik Revolution, we got way back into the Dark Ages again, in a sense, with all the technical advancements and all that, of course, but culturally speaking, it was very strange because, for me, I don't know other words, but the thing is that they started to build a new traditional society, basically, but based on a different set of rules and norms. But it was a traditional society based on belief in, in communism and not in a Christian God. They got all the same Christmas, but turn it into New Year with the same tree and the same habits and all the secularized, right?
Yes.
Secularized version of all that with all the religious icons, but at this time it was Lenin and Stalin and all those figures and of Jesus and so on. So basically all the same, but kind of perverted. And so this perverted kind of traditional society lasted for 70 years, and then by the beginning of the 1990s, it all got changed very rapidly with Gorbachev. And I cannot but think about the Chinese way, because they started to change their system by around the same time with Gorbachev, so it's the middle of the 80s.
Yeah.
And but they did it in a drastically different way. But what they did in China was that they issued a party, I don't know a technical term, probably a declaration or whatever, where they stated that 70% of what Mao did was correct. And 30% of what Mao did was wrong.
Right.
And by 30%, they meant the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap, and all that. And by 70% of the good stuff was the establishment of the Democratic Republic and all this stuff. But what's important is not what the percentage is, but they acknowledged that they have a foundation to build upon and to go forward.
Right.
And what Russians love to do is we deny the past and try to go forward. So that happened with the Bolsheviks in 1917, because the main slogan was, we will destroy this world of oppression to the ground, and then we will build our own new bright world. Okay.
Yeah.
That was the slogan.
A beautiful bright world of egalitarianism, at least in theory, that is probably sort of proto-green, right?
I think it's kind of post green in the ideal world. The problem is that as we now know, people have to be evolved enough to make that world sustainable enough, because if it's only an idea in one or two people's heads, and then the majority of the people is on a traditional level, so they take this ideal as a guiding rule and then try to, well, nothing good happens anyway.
Right. Well put.
And another point is that, as we also now know, you cannot build something new unless you acknowledge your past, okay, and go forward from that. But that's what happened first with the Bolsheviks in 1917. And that's, again, same thing happened with Gorbachev's perestroika, right? Because when the liberals came to power in the very beginning of the 90s, the idea was pretty much the same. All that communists did was awful, bad, wrong, and so on. So we have to build everything anew, right? We have to start from the first start with everything that they did was bad. Now we'll do something new and good.
Right.
And again, I've just told you about this Chinese example where they said, okay, let's decide how much bad there was and how much good there was. And
don't you love that 70-30? It's like you can fit anything into either of those.
Precisely, because if you think about it, of course, the Great Leap, which like killed tens of millions of people,
right.
And then the Cultural Revolution that was like pretty awful and lasted for like more than 10 years, where all the cultural elite was either killed or marginalized or whatever,
right.
Ridiculed, you know. It was awful, but then they decided, okay, that's gonna be 30%.
Right.
because you think about it, when you compare 70 and 30, 30 sounds not that bad. Okay.
No, that's right. 70. No, totally. No, it's actually quite optimistic, and it's like, okay, we can fix 30%. Let's keep the 70. Let's keep going. We got some good stuff going here. And you're saying the Russians didn't do that. The Russians want to blow up the past, forget about the past, and rewrite the script.
Precisely, and I think the reason that was the case is that there was no traditional foundation left. Okay.
Right.
Because the traditional stage of development was so perverted by that time by the communists that the people who had a more liberal mindset, or they were educated in the West, or whatever, of course they didn't want to do anything with that. And so they decided to build a liberal Western political system, economical system from scratch. But what happened, in fact, is that now we refer to the 90s, we Russians refer to the 90s here as our dark ages. Hungry 90s or awful 90s, because people were killed on the streets. I mean, not as in hunger riots or something like that, but in like bandit killings, shootings, and all that.
Yeah.
So it was like banditism was high at that point. It was like pretty awful. Precisely because if you think about it in developmental terms, when you don't have traditional amber and you try to kind of deconstruct it and decide we don't need this traditional amber anymore, we'll build orange, liberal, something new, something Western. What happens is that instead of building, that, what appears is red.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what happened. And then that red, egoistic, narcissistic, power-driven, wealth, power, and all that, maniacs who appeared on the scene in the beginning and middle of the 90s, they are now the rulers of the country.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much what happened, because the ones who were the greediest and probably the luckiest at that point, and it was total anarchy at that time, so it was easy to get a lot of wealth in a relatively short amount of time by cheating and stealing from the country and so on. Because what happened is that during the Soviet time, all of the factories, all of the enterprises were state owned.
Yeah.
And in the beginning of the with Perestroika and by the beginning of the 90s, everything became private owned.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were just cutting shares from that. They didn't deserve it, didn't earn it, didn't do anything for it. They just happened to own a lot of things. Okay. And so those who accumulated the most became the rulers of Russia in the 2000s. Okay. So that's the whole of the history, right? So my point in exploring the past was just to show that it was only in the 19th century where we started to kind of develop our own perspective on what it means to be liberal Russian. Okay,
right.
But then the Bolsheviks came and the new perverted traditional society kind of ideal and technically it was a traditional society. And then although industrialized and not nuclear weapon and all that. And then when it ended in the beginning of the 90s, then they didn't realize that what was needed was not to go search for the Western type of orange, but instead to build a real ember, instead to cure the perverted ember and to turn it into a healthy version of ember, and then to try and develop our own orange from that, or more liberal from that. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and that healthy amber, Victor, being things like, honesty and hard work and caring for each other and, those values of dignity and chastity and obedience and in a good way, where you, it's very much truly a communal meme. And as you say, they were trying to build an orange on top of a sort of hollowed out amber. Which then just dropped the situation down to red. And so the red's infecting the orange.
Yes. Well. What happens is a sort of a boom right thing in a sense that they use orange values to cover their red means.
Yeah, right.
Or needs and needs. And now they actually use amber values to cover their red needs, because what looks like happening now is that there is this protest movement, not like in Ukraine, if you follow that those events there in Ukraine that are happening now,
sort of a revolution.
Sort of a revolution, or hope.
We'll see how it goes. God bless them.
Because it seems that they are more active in a civil way than Russians are. Russians are more passive, in this regard. But so what happens with the protest movement, and there were quite a few happenings here in Russia, in Moscow in particular, with a few hundreds of thousands of people getting on the streets. But, well, not getting too far with that, but still, it was quite an achievement a year ago.
Yes, it was.
So what happens is that it seems like people are kind of looking for the orange or green even society, because it's most of them are cultural workers, like. I don't know, painters, programmers, and people like that. people who spend some time on the internet and young and so on. But so it looked like it's all kind of a green protest against the amber rulers. Okay, it looked like that. But in a sense, what happens is people want normal amber. People want rules to mean something, okay?
Yes.
Because that's the point. That's the point of amber, as opposed to red, with all these people in power now, who set rules for everyone but themselves.
Yes.
And it doesn't work because people are too educated not to notice that. And that's probably one of the biggest achievements of the Bolsheviks. Okay, they eradicated illiteracy radically. Okay, that was one of the greatest probably achievements of the Bolsheviks in the 20s and 30s. So what happens is people really just want normal functioning society based on rules and norms which everyone has to follow and obeys. And then what we see is that the people in power don't follow these rules and don't obey those rules. And at the same time, they use those rules to oppress people, because many people now are in prisons for nothing, okay, for doing really nothing.
Right.
Well, or nothing wrong. Okay, for doing something but not wrong. And then those red guys, they say, okay, but we are not red. In fact, we are amber. We are in fact blue, because we care for the traditional society. That's why they have very good connections with Russian Orthodox Church.
Right.
And
isn't this also the the putting forth the gay
exactly, yeah,
the laws,
exactly.
You know, sort of
yeah.
marginalizing homosexuals?
Right. So they want to show that we are
traditional values.
You know, yeah, but it's nothing more than just a cover, you know.
Right.
Well,
that's true. That's true, Victor. I would point out here as well. I mean, there are a lot of states in America that have very similar laws. In fact, there's eight of them. It was pointed out that have very similar laws to what was just written in Russia about gays. 20, 30 years ago, it was not really a good idea to come out in these places. In some places,
right.
It still isn't. So,
right.
You know, that's you can get traditional, you know, religious people worked up about that pretty easily, and that, you know, sort of passes for amber, but
right.
It's horseshit,
right.
You know.
Right. No, exactly. So that's why I say that it's just a cover thing for, you know,
yeah.
we are traditional, we are strengthening the vertical, that's what they say, okay? The word being the vertical meaning the vertical of power, okay? So because if you compare Putin to Yeltsin, obviously you get like in Putin you get a strong leader, and he likes to you know, all these topless photographs of him with like you see his muscles, and he's riding all these driving cars and airplanes and submarines and all that, you know. So he's a real like male figure. Okay.
Right.
And in comparison to a drunk who was falling from the stairs and all that, namely
which
Yeltsin,
was Yeltsin.
Yes, it is a big change, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
So what he did, he organized the crime. Okay, it was anarchy and chaos in Yeltsin's time, so everyone was just fighting for himself. And now everyone who fights for himself, in a red sense, so like for power, for wealth, or something like that, they don't last long unless they convert for a convert to kind of to put in France, basically. Okay, so he organized all this process, and he organized it the way that now it all leads to him on top.
Yeah.
So some of the analytics say that he's probably one of the wealthiest people in the world, which sounds strange, but still, you know, which might be true as far as we all know. So, to conclude this part and to kind of switch to the Olympics, I suppose, it's all similar to that. Lots of money were spent on making this image for Russia, but if you look to a hospital or if you look into what happens to schools here or to universities or to factories and so on, it's pretty awful. Okay, or to the army or whatever, any pretty much every branch of human endeavor and human society here in Russia is just very, very bad. Okay, the situation is not good at all.
Yeah.
But then it's more important to make this image, you know, that okay, we're getting better. And look at our Olympics opening. It was a good show. I mean,
yeah,
it was a good
I thought
show.
So
I liked it. It was not bad. Because the initial thought was that all the money would go to people's pockets, to you know, certain people's pockets, and nothing will good will happen there. But no, it was a good show, and they spent money on that. But still, you know, maybe half of that or two thirds of that was stolen anyway. And that's what happened, you know. People make different projects, like big projects, and they just cut the budget. That's how it's done, and most of these projects are done for that purpose. Get money from the government and cut the budget, you know, and say we did it. So many people are criticizing the Olympics for that, you know, because a lot of money were spent on that, probably yeah. beautiful and interesting and whatever event, but it's not what has to be done.
Right? Yeah.
So that's the main critique.
No, I can definitely dig it. It's a lot of money, and yet it is, from our perspective over here in America, you know, there's a lot of criticism here too. And actually, it's funny. You can look back and see the criticism in Vancouver, the criticism in Utah. The Olympics are always sort of embroiled in criticism, and to the degree that a country's economy is still not even rule bound, you know, not even sort of amber good, you know, bureaucracy with courts and rules.
Right.
It's going to be full of graft. That's
right.
Just the preceding system. And that's what, you know, a more amber economy. It's one of the things that I've been talking about with Saeed Dalabani. I don't know if you know him. He just wrote Memeonomics. But it's about the development of economies and government structures are actually very, very lagging emergence. They're the last to come along. And even in America, right now, we're moving from an orange system in terms of our economy and government to a green system. And you folks are probably moving, you know, as you say, you have this special problem of that sort of hollowed out amber that just sort of needs to be rebuilt. Do you see any movement in that direction? I mean, you know, a lot of times it's just people thinking right about it. You know, that's the first thing that has to happen.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's why, you know, just to sort of round out the picture, we see that culture, and you talk about poets and writers and, you know, the intelligentsia, you. Your job is to think, you know, you're the leading emergent.
Well, hopefully. that's what I'm doing now. That's why I came back here from China, and that's why I have these intergroup groups, and that's why we launched this online journal and all that, because that's what has to happen. First comes the information, and then the formation. So we have to inform to make the form happen. Arise. And yes, basically that's what has to happen now. First is understanding what healthy amber means for Russia.
Yeah.
At all. Because I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
It was so long ago that it has to be kind of there have to be many people working on that project to happen. Basically.
Yeah,
that's what I mean, probably. And for that to happen, we have to begin to inform people that's what has to happen.
Exactly.
Okay. And the second thing is then not just mimicking, not just copying of the Western orange type
right.
of development, because it had its own two or three centuries of development, okay?
Yeah.
And if we just copy it, just try to mimic it, it doesn't work this way, okay? It has to evolve by itself from healthy traditional society and from healthy rules and norms and all that and freedom yeah. that follow it. The freedoms that are decided by the rules and not by the one or two people in power,
right.
red power in this case, who decide what's right and what's wrong. So,
yeah.
So yes, as I see it now, imagine America a few hundred years ago.
Okay? Yeah.
And it's Russia is a newborn, basically, now, that tries to speak and walk and all that before it actually can do, though. So,
it's interesting. It's interesting to see every country do its thing in terms of moving into modernity when the grooves are already cut in the West, but we have our own pathologies around it.
Right.
We have a lot, you know, there are a lot deeper grooves. There are grooves. I think a great example of doing it differently is China.
Absolutely, yes.
They're bringing, you know, millions of people into at least decent living from abject poverty, and they're, you know, not democratic.
Yes, I absolutely agree.
And in a way, I think, thank God they're not democratic.
Well, they cannot be because the majority of people are too illiterate, you know, and you cannot
exactly.
Democratic when there is illiteracy and most
right.
people cannot fight by themselves, you know.
Yeah, and completely ethnocentric and, you know,
yes.
unsophisticated. So, you know, this is where the elites in these countries, their right to do their thing and hopefully, you know, be a sort of self-cleansing as possible and play off of, you look at, yeah, exactly. And, you know, exactly. I mean, it's funny to think of cultures as having sort of dominant monads, so to speak, that they actually have personalities.
Right.
And they do. And what would you say, Victor, is the personality of Russia? Is what Enya type? Or what? How could you help us understand you, folks?
It's a good question. I was just thinking, about it a few minutes ago when I was saying that we still have to learn how to walk and learn how to talk and all that, still being a newborn and all that. But at the same time, the problem is that Russia is a huge country. First, and second, that it appears to be or wants to be or is, in a sense, one of the world's leading countries in many senses, as a, one of the big powers.
Yes, indeed.
In today's world. I think it was so maybe in the 19th and 18th century and whatever, but mostly probably after the Second World War, the victory over the Nazis, where the world was kind of decided upon by the United States, British Empire, and Soviet Union, basically.
Yes.
So that's the paradox that we have to kind of integrate. That on one hand there is this huge huge country with rich history, which with all these beautiful achievements in cultural things, poetry and literature and all that, which is a treasure for the whole world and all that. And at the same time, being politically and economically newborn. That's probably one of the paradoxes that we have to acknowledge first.
Yeah.
Not to try to seem to understand what's happening there, because well, if we are such a rich culture with all the Dostoevskys and Tolstoys and all that, how can we be political imbeciles? How can we be economic imbeciles? But yes, we can. You know, why not? Okay.
Very funny.
Let's do something about it. I think that Russian people lack a drive for action.
Mm-hmm.
Like even though we had this, had those moments of Bolshevik Revolution and all that, but people are still very, very passive about doing something for themselves, and at the same time too egoistic to do something for others as well.
Okay. Right.
It was a very good observation by one of Russian's web designers, most famous web designers. He said that for Russian people, their personal space, their private space, ends with the door of their apartment. Okay, so for example, the apartment is neat and nice and clean and all that. But what happens on the staircase, no one cares.
Okay? Right.
Whereas if you go to Europe, everyone thinks of their staircases and streets as an extension of their house, of their
right.
Of their apartment, so you wouldn't want to spoil that. You wouldn't want to put garbage there. You wouldn't want to I don't know.
Right. Well, it's such a paradox that communism was actually, in some ways, drove out the communal or suffocated.
Right.
Or
yes.
You know, it's a paradox of karmic history.
Right, it was probably more egoistic than some of the Western types of democracy, you know. And that's basically the idea, because again, with traditional values not being integrated, what you have is egoistic values. Okay.
Yes, that's right.
You don't. You don't want anything for your neighbor. You want everything for yourself.
Right. Right.
Okay. And so with this, if you go to free market economy and all that, you get red, obviously.
Yeah.
Because that's what happens. Everyone just fights for himself or herself. So in terms of the current unfolding with all this civil movement in Russia, I think what happens is people begin to self-organize into groups, basically. So people begin to understand that many people want this, and that those ones who want something to change, they're not alone. Okay, so that's an important part, and probably for this kind of passive modality of the Russian soul, of the mysterious Russian soul, as we like to call it, you know. And as you said, very dreamy kind of suffering kind of attitude.
Yeah.
Melancholic, yeah. So the mysterious Russian soul.
Yeah. Oh yes. There you go.
Yeah. So people begin to understand that actually there are many people who want the same, want something to change, and that empowers, of course. That empowers you if you understand that if you go to the streets, then many people go to the streets. You're not just alone. And it helps to build a healthier. I don't know if it's traditional per se, but it is communal, of course, right?
Yes.
Less individualistic, more communal. And I'd love to see that happen more.
Yeah.
So, because for now it's only a small minority of people still living in it.
Well, Victor, does it seem dangerous? Are people just unsure of, you know, how safe it is, or do you feel like there is, you know, at least enough freedom of expression that you don't feel nervous about that?
Oh no, everyone's nervous.
Yeah.
It is pretty scary still because we don't know what happens next, and by all the actions of the government, we see that they don't care much about the public opinion in the West or in the country.
Right.
So they do pretty much what they want. So no one really knows what happens if many people go out the street.
Right.
So it can become messy, but at the same time, I sometimes think that maybe it is necessary for something to become messy, for, you know, to kind of to accelerate the unfolding of this process, because otherwise, you know, well, things are getting better. You know, people earn relatively more money. People can afford buying better cell phones. Something like that. Urban people, not village people.
Yeah.
Urban people.
Right. But I was just going to say that is significant. If people feel that their material well-being is improving, they'll put up with some stuff to get there.
Right, and also it's good for the government, because if the basic needs are covered, and the basic modality of the basic stage of the majority of population is amber or red, then if you cover these needs, people don't aspire for more. You know,
mm-hmm.
We are relatively okay.
Yeah.
And it's only those people who actually care for the world-centric problem, who want something to change. Okay, so
and what percentage of the population is that, Victor, would you say?
It's not a lot. Well, let's say let's say, in those protests and in Moscow a few years ago, there were a few hundred thousand people, right? Mm-hmm. And it's pretty much all there is, okay? Because, well, that's Moscow and St. Petersburg, and that's it. So mm-hmm. it's probably like less than 1%.
Yeah.
Less than 1% of people who are active enough. Yeah. So that's another thing that I, as a teacher or integral facilitator, have to do, informing people, is that, well, action is necessary.
Yeah.
And
you mentioned that sometimes, you know, action is necessary, of course, and sometimes it gets messy. So I wanted to ask you about Pussy Riot.
Right.
Talk about some, you know, wild social action that's really gotten a lot of attention internationally.
Right.
It's amazing.
Right.
These girls know their PR.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Oof. Because the event itself was pretty much nothing, okay?
Right.
Then it was all those really, really stupid actions by the government that led to this international fame and all that. So the government made everything wrong. Every step was just completely wrong. Probably because they just don't realize these modern globalized things work nowadays.
Yeah.
Okay. They still think they're in the Soviet Union, so they try to deal with these things in a Soviet Union way, which doesn't work now. So basically what had to be done is there could be a fine or something like that for the misbehavior, for the what's the word? I'm not very good with English. So one we have two laws. One is like a criminal law and one
misdemeanor.
Law, something like that. So they could be treated for a misdemeanor and it would get no attention.
Exactly.
But precisely.
And what we're talking about, of course, for people who don't maybe remember, is they did a wild punk performance on the altar of a church, correct?
Right, and it's kind of it's the main church in Russia, in Moscow.
Yeah.
It's a newly built church. Very, very, very expensive. Very, very kind of beautiful and all that, but at the same time, everyone kind of feels it's fake, okay? Because
mm-hmm.
it was precisely this bond, this connection between the government, the people in power, and the leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church, who decided to legitimize their connection by building this huge frankly quite ugly construction, okay, with the elevators inside and all that kind of, you can rent space to organize your birthday parties. It's pretty strange. It is a huge church anyway. Icons and all that. But the point is that many people consider it fake. Okay.
Right.
So that was the reason those girls chose that place to perform.
Oh, I understand. Okay.
Or so I interpret it anyway. What they were doing is they were kind of praying to God in a song, saying, please expel Putin. Oh God, please expel Putin. Okay. They were saying Mother Mary. Okay. They were saying Mother Mary, please make Putin go. Basically, that's
right.
What they
Yes. Mean.
Okay.
Yes. Wow.
And and they lasted there for, I think, less than 1 minute before they were caught. Okay. And then it went on from there.
Right.
So, of course, it was just a completely wrong succession of actions by the government, who wanted to kind of show that they respect. Again, it's the same. They don't care, of course. Who cares?
Right.
I mean, you know.
Right.
But they wanted to show that their traditional values are traditional enough.
Right.
And it's the same with this anti-gay laws and all that. That, okay,
right.
We are so respectful of the Russian church that we just cannot pass it for a minor misbehavior, misdemeanor.
Right.
We have to kind of, we have to judge those poor girls and let them go to prison for that for a few years,
right.
Which is completely insane, completely insane.
Right. Well, yeah, and certainly not good PR for Putin and you know, the government.
Internationally.
The two of them are, and how do you pronounce their names? I'd like to give them a shout out.
Maria Alekhina, Nadezhda Tolokonnikova, and I know those two.
I
remember those two. Yes, I think they are now on tour in the U.S.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're guests of Amnesty International, so they're, you know, on all the shows, and they're just, you know, delightful and smart, and you know, they're just a perfect, iconic sort of protest figure.
They're very smart and very good and all that.
Yeah.
We're just they were probably doing anyway. I'm not a cultural critic to pretend I understand that it was an act of art as they claimed it to be. But it was this art group, War. Their name was War.
Right.
That were doing these different kind of performances, but performances including real policemen and real government officials and all that, and they were doing like wild stuff, lots of wild stuff. So that was just one of the last their performances, the last. So yes, it's very interesting, and I think that of course Putin didn't foresee that it would turn to such a world famous event, and that Putin was to be blamed for all that and all that. But at the same time, you see that they were all set free before the Olympics.
They
here come back to the Olympics, and same with Mikhail Khodorkovsky, okay, who was a convict, and like he that was a complete farce, right?
Mm-hmm.
That process as well, and it was 100% political, and simply because he was a personal enemy, and he still is a personal enemy of Putin, and the difference is, and here we come back to the same story of Reds and Embers and all that. The Mikhail Khodorkovsky, for those who don't know, was one of the key people in the late 90s, early 2000s, one of the wealthiest persons in Russia, owning the biggest oil company.
Right. Is this the guy who's really tall?
No. That's another
the
one.
The basketball guy. Okay. All right.
So this
guy's his name is Mikhail Kolakovsky.
Yes, Khodorkovsky.
Yeah. Okay.
And he soon became a political dissident, basically, because he was put to prison for 10 years by Putin, and the accusation, the charges were just completely insane. It was just all pure bullshit, like 100%. They just wanted him to go to prison, okay? And they made him go to prison. And he was also set free like a few months ago with the girls before the Olympics, because many countries as well, at least that's how we now think about it, is that many countries leaders pushed kind of Putin to do so.
Well, that's where the things like the Olympics have a potent evolutionary force, because it turns out that countries do want to look good to each other. It's the strangest thing.
Right.
It's just like people.
Right. Right.
It's expensive, and it's got a lot of downside, but it also has a significant upside, I think.
Well, I agree, of course. That's a good thing that they're finally out. and I also wanted to mention the reason why he got there, because he was one of the wealthiest people, getting all the money and all the power from the late 80s. With all this rapid change and free market and the end of the government-owned, state-owned factories and oil plants and all that. Yeah. So what was different is that he really had an orange mindset. So that's what made him really, really different. And that he just, or so I interpret, of course, didn't want to play by red rules, and
right.
he did a lot for the country by that time, and he put forth some very advanced scholarships for the scientists and for the different educational projects and so on, and he was doing a lot. Okay, but he just didn't want to play by red rules, and so he was punished by red laws.
Right.
And while staying in prison for 10 years, he was writing beautiful stuff. Like the things he wrote, I make him pretty much like Russian, well, I wouldn't say like Russian Nelson Mandela or something like that, but quite a thinker, okay? Quite a thinker.
Will he be able to continue his work openly now? Is he, he's free and...
Well,
will he take on a dissident sort of voice in the culture?
He's not allowed to go back to the country, as far as I understand. So
oh, I see. So he's... He left the country.
Yes, that was the deal. Basically, after it happened, he was telling to the press that he was staying in the colony there in prison one day, and out of the blue he was approached by a few people. Actually, he didn't even know that's going to happen, and they took him, they put him to a car, and then they took him to the airplane, and then he didn't even know where the airplane goes until it landed
right.
in Berlin. Okay. And they said, okay, now you stay here and you're
wow.
free. I'd love to see him as one of the main political figures, obviously, yes. Will he? I don't know, but time will tell, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, you're doing your part, Victor. Can you tell us a little bit about your theater and the kind of things you're actually putting on stage?
Well, it's a state theater. It's a state theater, it's not a private theater, and the director, the art director and one of the playwrights, he's very into integral, and he his name is Ivan Verpaev, and he's a quite famous playwright in Europe. Many European theaters also stage his plays. And now he was chosen to be the director for this theater, to be this theater's head for the next 3 years, I think. And he's very interested in integral and in the spiritual practices and in development, cultural development and psychology and all that. So he's a public figure, and when he speaks about integral or about Ken Wilber, many people listen, and it can become and so it can become a new cultural trend, you know, because it's cool to be integral, you know, because he is integral. Which can be a bad thing, but it is still, it can be a good thing, because more people will just know these names and these books and all that. So some
Absolutely.
Of them might become actually interested in all that stuff. So that's pretty good. That's integral publicity in Russia.
Absolutely.
Right now. And it's really good. And he happened to know me through the integral circles. And as I said in the very beginning, well, there are maybe like 20 people, 20 or even less, like active integral people who do something with mm-hmm. integral, either teaching, promoting, translating, and so on. And publishing. And so he happened to know me and decided I'm a good candidate for organizing this integral theory group or integral practice group in his theater. And so wow. I planned 32 lessons, sessions.
Uh-huh, sure, yeah.
It's weekly, on weekly basis. So every Sunday we meet for 3 hours. And then based on the topic of this week, I post some readings and post some exercises and so on online. So we have a uh-huh. small online group. So it's modeled a little bit after the distance learning program in the JFK University that I was studying at. But we have weekly gatherings. So it's like 32, meaning it's 8 months. So it's quite uh-huh. a big program.
That's wonderful.
Four in the fall and four months now. So we end by the end of May, I think, or early June. There are around 15 or 16 students. Some of them are actors, some of them are directors, some of them are theater managers. So that was the original idea of Ivan, who wanted all of the theater-related people to be in the group. Not just yeah. actors, but also managers and directors. So it's going quite fine, I think.
Yeah.
It's
significant. I mean, that you're magnetizing other integral thinkers to get together. It's, you know, it reminds me of what Ken talked about with the beginning of modernity, is that people basically just got together. We're talking the 1500s, 1600s, you know, in Europe.
Yeah.
People just got together and talked about it for 300 years before there was really any action, but that's an essential step.
Right. No, I think people relate to what I teach is maybe a big word, but it's what I tell.
Well, yes.
It is teaching, yes, obviously. Yeah. I do lectures and presentations and all that. And we do some exercises kind of related to the topic and some discussions. So next Sunday we'll talk about integral art and the development of art from the integral perspective and the developmental perspective. So
wonderful.
The evolution of art from the primitive art to the you know, to like kind of a Gipsarian approach with the adding more perspectives.
Yes.
So we come to the a perspectival.
Yes.
So that's what will happen next Sunday. Yes. And I feel people relate to that because many of them have their own spiritual paths and their own spiritual questions and answers, and they all. They're all interested in what happened to art and what art actually is. And then I hope that developmental psychology and developmental perspective on cultural evolution can help put some light on that. I see that it does. I'm really curious how to deliver it to people. Yeah, and but it relates on that.
Sounds wonderful.
And from what I see, they do relate to that. So.
Yeah. Well, come on. I think the verdict's in. You're a bunch of fours. You're a bunch of Enneagram fours looking at art.
Oh, well, I'm in room nine. So.
No, I don't know. But no, that's wonderful. And, you know, Integral has a lot to say about art and everything, you know, basically. And once you have the integral view, you know, this sort of ability to take perspectives to see what's best about virtually everything and, you know, how it emerges into a new complexity and even simplicity. Is just delightful, and once you get a taste of that, nothing else will do.
Right. In some of the presentations of the integral approach that I do now, and these few weeks I did quite a few actually for a bunch of people. I tell them that we can relate to integral in four different ways, and obviously maybe in five or seven. Whatnot,
right.
I choose to focus
right.
on these four. And one is it's an answer to the to challenges of current situations in the world, that we need this integral view just to help us organize the all the information that we have access to now in ways that we can understand what this information is and what for. Okay.
Right.
And what can we do with that? And then second is a certain worldview of a certain stage of development. Then third is that it can be looked at as an instrument, as a tool to apply to, you know, and to apply to your life, business, and whatnot. And fourth is that it's a vehicle of transformation. You know, it. In and of itself,
right,
and I think the fourth one is what I'm actually teaching, or so I hope that I present integral as a means of transformation for the individual and for the society. And so when people get engaged with that, they.
Yeah.
They see by themselves that, oh yes, integral, because now you and I, we speak kind of from inside that, right? And so we say, yeah, it can be applied to virtually everything. And obviously it can apply to virtually everything because it's our worldview, okay? We see everything through these lenses. And we see that it's good to see everything from these lenses. And it's clarifying, and it's liberating, and so on, and
yeah.
and so that's my aspiration, just
right.
to well, to transmit basically this worldview and this vehicle of transformation forward for those guys who can do something about it, about the current situation in Russia as well and in the world, to do something about it, being integrally informed about it.
Yeah, well, you're doing what many of us are doing. You know, I could say that it's the same thing about me, and that, you know, I'm just trying to help people see this, I think, bigger, more compassionate, effective, all of the above, this vision that, you know, is really, I think, next. So it's been great talking to you, Victor.
Thanks.
Is there anything, you know, I'd like to publish this call if you agree, and, you know, some integral people around here will listen to it, and, you know, is there anything you'd like to tell us?
Well, first,
in addition to what you've already said.
Right. Well, first, I think that it's important to understand that Integral is not confined to the West, meaning that it's not confined to the States,
right,
for example. And I think it's important to realize that it's something that can be applied and that is being currently applied for different situations all around the world, and that there are different people who actually do something about that in all parts of the world. So that's maybe one of the most important things.
Yes.
If we really want to see that as a new emerging wave of social cultural evolution, which we are.
Yes.
which we do.
Yes.
Well, and hopefully, which we are.
Yeah.
But time will tell, of course, and it's a step-by-step process. And as you said earlier, first it's just people talking and thinking about it, who actually carve those first cosmic grooves, which might become next cosmic habits, which they are, of course, now as a minor kind of occurrence, but hopefully as a more of a cosmic habit in some hopefully not so distant future. Yes.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And we all feel that it's pretty important for that to happen also, if we want this world not to end before its time. And so again, I just want to stress that it was great to talk about this stuff, because I think it is really important to understand that it's a worldwide thing, that that even though Integral, as we know it now, was developed and presented to us by Ken, it is being read all over the world, and people relate to that easily. I mean, it's an instant thing. You just recognize that, oh yeah, okay, yes, that's true. I just didn't know how to structure it before, how to formulate it before. And then, oh, so many there is so much research on that stuff going on as well. So it's not just my thoughts anymore. It's a huge thing going on. I mean,
I know.
Harvard and so I think that's the most important thing, to realize that for something to be sustainable, it has to have a strong diversified foundation. Meaning,
yes,
many different groups of many different types of people doing,
yes,
doing this same stuff. So I'm happy just to talk to you and to make this perspective known, and to make this part of the world known for your audience.
All right, Victor. Well, thank you so much, and stay in touch. I'd like to see how your work goes, and if you ever come to the States, please come to Colorado, and you can stay in my guest house.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the invitation, and I've visited once with the JFK cohort, and it was awesome. I mean, yeah. Visited California 2 times and Colorado once. And Colorado is a fine place. I liked it very much. Hopefully sometime.
Yeah, cool.
Thanks for the invitation again.
Okay, Victor. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay. Yep. Bye. Thanks.